There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast bringing the best bit of today's show together in one place. Thursday, October the 10th.
But have you got the skills to pay the bills? Apparently some of us lack them here in the UAE. That's according to the World Economic Forum. Their latest report on competitiveness is largely kind to the UAE. We have climbed two places from 27th to 25th. In some things, we are the best in the world, literally. When it comes to macroeconomic stability, nobody can beat us. And we score really, really well on many things like flexible labour markets and an open market. However, they have identified some areas for improvement, and these are the ones that we're most interested in.
Yep, and it is the skills. They say that if we laid the foundations to create a sounder innovation system, boosting human capital, then the UAE would become one of the most competitive countries in the world. It would pop us up those rankings. But to be fair, they're looking at everyone when it comes to skills. There's quite a bit in this report about the importance of talent adaptability, that people basically need to do two things. Number one, be part of the disruptive technology trend, so contribute to effectively what they call creative destruction processes. Sounds like the sort of thing that your mother tells you you're not allowed to do at home.
It's Schumpeter, isn't it? Creative destruction.
Exactly. But you also have to be ready to be disrupted. You have to be able to cope with your industry being shaken up.
They've come up with a dreadful word for it, haven't they?
Flexicurity.
Yeah, I don't like that at all. But I take their point. I do agree with them on the general premise. We got lots and lots of response on this today. Thanks very much indeed. One of the questions we're asking is, what's the one skill that you're worried about that you don't have for the future of your career? Awais says that just having skills on paper, well, that's not going to cut it.
For me, it's very important, yes, to have a skill or have many skills, either they are latest or the old ones. It's more important is that what do you exactly do with those skills? Not it's similar to having a degree. You can be a master's degree holder or a PhD, but it doesn't really matter unless you do something with those skills.
Thanks, Awais. Lots of people getting in touch on Twitter as well. At Yoheswan, Yoga Yoheswaran says everyone should know how to create a mobile app website. And also, which I really like, everyone should know how to perform first aid, especially CPR. We neglect the really important skills sometimes, don't we?
Yeah, we absolutely do. Look, everything everyone's getting in touch with falls into two camps. One is the tech camp. The other is the soft skills camp. So people are saying, you know, you need to understand cloud computing. Someone's messaged in to say, I don't even know where the cloud is. Social media and the rest of it. But there's a lot of talk about communication skills as well. Empathy, the ability to just get on with someone else in the workplace.
Well, I'm looking at the LinkedIn list of the most in-demand skills in the workplace. This is a global list, but it tells you a lot. And they break it into soft skills and hard skills, with the caveat that they say that distinction is becoming less and less relevant. Anyway, just for clarity, they've done just that. And in reverse order, the most in-demand hard skills are user experience design, which I guess is technological. The next two are more human, people management and analytical reasoning. And then the top two are tech skills, artificial intelligence and cloud computing. But if we look at the soft skills, again, in reverse order, the top five. Number five, time management, which you thought was basically just adulting, being a grown-up, but clearly not. Adaptability, which speaks to that awful word that the World Economic Forum came up with, which was again?
Flexicurity.
Ouch, I prefer adaptability. Number three is collaboration, playing nicely with others. Number two is persuasion, and I guess you could have that as a kind of proxy for communication. And number one, creativity. Creativity. Those are the ones people want. We've been speaking to a recruitment expert here in Dubai to find out, practically speaking, on the ground at the moment in Dubai, what are the skills that employers want the most? John Eade is the director of Michael Page in the Middle East, and this is what he told us.
Look, I'm sure it won't be too much of a surprise that it's technology. So a few years ago, when the buzzword was coming out around digital, there was a huge amount of hype in the market, and lots of our clients really, really wanted our help in terms of hiring these digital skills. Unfortunately, it's only really the last 2 years that companies have actually worked out what they really want, what they really need in terms of delivering the digitization of their businesses. We've seen a lot of activity in FS, in real estate, telecoms, even in sort of F&B around digitizing those businesses. But it's only really the last sort of 12, 24 months that companies have actually understood what they need in terms of transforming their business.
Another expert in this field is David Van Lockham. He's the founder and CEO of a company called Augmented Workforce. And as its name suggests, they're using a lot of these new technologies to do what they do. And he agreed with John about the gap in tech skills, but he did explain to us the specific sectors that are lacking this knowledge.
It's not a traditional IT skills that we're looking for. So despite your great background in Word and Power, probably some other office applications, that's not what I'm referring to. I'm referring to new technologies. Like Anitja mentioned AI, you can clearly see that. What does it mean AI for business? Because artificial intelligence on its own is often not enough. We are also looking for people that have context. So when you have machine learning, for example, it's important that you understand in which context the insight should be placed. So we need people that can bridge that. And yes, there are many other, let's say, new technologies that people are looking at. Also think about things like biometrics are in demand. I think on GITEX we saw a lot around biometrics. So yeah, the new technologies, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but how do you make sure that your kids have got them? That's the question. Brendan Fulton is executive principal at the Dubai British School. And we've asked him, what are you doing to make sure that you're teaching kids now the stuff that's going to get them employed in the future?
We're far less interested in predicting what the skills gap may be and far more interested in teaching children how to learn generally. So the latest buzz is ideas that things like learning a language is no longer important, but we focus less on the fact that children are learning a language and more on how they learn a language and the transferable skills that they get through that process.
How are what skills kids are being taught in schools actually evolving?
Very much so. I mean, in the past, schools were very bound by the curricula that they taught, which tended to be quite rigid. The curricula are far less rigid now, and schools are given a lot of flexibility to manipulate the curriculum to develop skills in a way that's meaningful for the students that they have. So for us, it's very much about using the British curriculum in a way that allows us to teach skills, problem solving, enterprise, critical thinking skills within the context of the British curriculum.
Are the actual skills, though, evolving? I mean, are you teaching stuff now that you wouldn't have taught 5 or 10 years ago?
Very much so. And not just teaching stuff, but taking advantage of stuff. The idea that there's a gap in technology skills, I understand where that comes from. But actually, the young children coming into schools these days are hugely adept at technology. And the gap actually exists in how the curriculum stifles that creativity with the use of technology. So it's about liberating the curriculum and the teaching to be able to allow students to use technology effectively to enhance their learning.
How do you teach the soft skills, the innovation, the creativity, the empathy, the stuff that we're told that we'll need because the machines can't do it?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, that has to be fully embedded into the curriculum. So many of the things that you've discussed on your show today, things like the expo, the Greta Thunberg, it's allowing students to engage in topical items that are currently happening and giving them an opportunity to think about what those mean in their life and to consider real world solutions to real world problems.
Brendan Fulton, Executive Principal of Dubai British School, thanks for your time.
Absolute pleasure.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
The UAE Central Bank removing the 3% early settlement fee for mortgages. What does that mean for homeowners and would-be homeowners? We're joined by Chris Shutrips, who's the Managing Director of Mortgage Finder, and Aaron Lomax, the CEO of Trio Homes. Guys, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Chris, do you want to run us through the facts? Do you want to tell us what the central bank's actually done?
So back in 2018, the central bank introduced a 3% penalty, which could be charged by the banks for any loss of income should a customer redeem a mortgage. Now, this was a principle where they left the banks open to interpretation of how they did it. And a lot of the banks applied this fee of 3% for the lifetime of the mortgage. And some of them went back to mortgages as far back as 2007. So what the central bank announced yesterday was that the maximum fee is now 1% or 10,000, whichever's less. That will be a great outcome for the consumers, because what we saw last year was the buyout market, the consumer choices of shopping around, almost completely died a death because the fee was such a substantial amount.
So what do you think we're going to actually see happen? What practical effects is going to have?
Well, I think I think it's a really positive move in the first instance by the central bank. There was some of the consumers weren't overly happy last year, and I think that this goes a long way to appeasing them, showing that mortgages are still a good option for purchasing. It allows people to refinance, because what you'll find is that if your property values come down a little bit, you could be paying an extremely high interest rate, maybe 6-7%. By being able to refinance, buy out, you're going to be able to get a much lower rate, which makes it more affordable for the people here.
Will we see a wave of people switching lenders, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think, I think that was one of the concerns why this was brought in the first place, and why the banks welcomed it, was they didn't want to see a churn rate of consumers shopping around and a certain element of disloyalty. But I think for the consumers who need to either sell or who need to refinance, it's going to be a really good outcome for them.
Will it encourage new buyers, though, Aaron? What do you reckon?
I think this move is a more towards the seller's side of things than the buyer's side of things, because that will have a knock-on effect on the buyers, because if you're looking to sell your property, if you've got a loan amount of around 1.5 million dirhams and you're looking to sell, you're going to be paying almost 50,000 dirhams in penalty charges to close that mortgage, whereas now it will be capped at 10,000 dirhams, so it does leave a little bit more in the pot for the sellers, and in turn, I'm sure that will filter into the buyers also.
We have seen, in general, a decrease in interest rates since the beginning of the year. We're expecting, I think, is it one more rate cut for the end of the year, Rich?
But one more rate cut in the next week or so, yeah. Some people are expecting.
What effect is that actually having on the amount of people applying for mortgages and the amount of people actually going through with purchases? Does it really boost the market?
Yeah, I think it does. And it also makes mortgages more affordable for the people that have them at the moment. Most of them have mortgages that track certain rates. They're pegged to the US dollar. So when we see the Fed reduce the rates to increase inflation in the US, that helps us in the mortgage market here. And we have seen really the mid-tier banks in the last 12 months have become very competitive on pricing.
Do you see a spike, though? I mean, if you were to draw me a graph, could you see, after Fed decisions and therefore UAE Central Bank decisions with rates, could you see a spike in applications?
I wouldn't say a significant spike. What it does is it makes because mortgages are still relatively new, not always used in the UAE. So the cheaper they are, the more affordable they are, the more appealing they are to the people that are buying. So coupled with the news on villas that we've released today, it all works out hand in hand.
Yeah, we do have some new data. We're going to get to that in a moment. Aaron, though, I want to ask you, are you having interest rate discussions with buyers? Do you see it as a motivation?
Definitely so. I mean, I think the rise in transactions is a lot down to renters turning into buyers. And a big aspect of that is people sitting down. Most end users are going with mortgages. So obviously, if interest rates come down, mortgages and interest will increase from the buy side also.
My question on the mortgage situation is that I don't see this as being a game changer, this decision. It's a nice to have and it's welcome. But there would be things, there would be rules on mortgages that could be game changers. And the one that you mentioned earlier on this morning, Chris, when you spoke to us, was potentially reducing the amount of deposit people have. And we've spoken before about this. At the moment, you need a minimum 25% deposit. You chuck in fees, etc. You're looking at basically a third of the value of any property you want to buy. You've got to have as loose change in your pocket. What really encourages me is that the central bank are clearly looking at mortgages. And this might be one of a raft of measures. What else would you like to see happening?
So we saw in this announcement, everyone's grabbed hold of the 1% free to one. But actually, we also saw the central bank allow the banks to extend the term of the mortgages. And that's really important because, as Aaron said, we see more end users than investors now. And being able to take the mortgage term, say, an extra 5 years, for example, does mean it creates even more affordable solution for people looking to buy.
We got questions coming in. Laura says, yeah, I've got a mortgage with XYZ Bank. There is a 3% buyout. Does that mean it will instantly change to 1%?
So we're waiting for how the banks interpret the guidance from the central bank. But the central bank's guidance is very clear. 1% is the maximum, or 10,000, whichever is lesser. So I think we can say with relative confidence that yes, that 3% is going to drop.
Aaron Lomax, the CEO of Treo Homes, appreciate your time, Aaron.
Thank you very much.
Also heard from Chris Shuttrips, Managing Director of Mortgage Finder. Thanks, Chris. Appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Saudi Aramco has a date for releasing the prospectus for its stock market listing. The Wall Street Journal says the Arabic version is going to be out on Friday, October the 25th, about 2 weeks' time. The English will come out a couple of days later. Joining us on the line from Riyadh now is Sean Evers, Managing Partner of Gulf Intelligence. So it sounds like this is really happening, this IPO of Aramco. What can you tell us? What have you learned in the corridors of power in Riyadh?
Well, I think for some time now, obviously this story is a few years old. It has gone through cycles in which it looked very likely and cycles in which it looked less likely. I think now we're firmly on a path to this happening. It's no longer if, it's really about when. It's become the cornerstone of the economic reform program in the kingdom. And so with that, it's become really a symbol. So it's not really about the scale, the dollar number. It's about it happening as a cornerstone, as a symbol of the economic reform program. So it has to happen really at this stage. And the all indicators are in this calendar year before the in the fourth quarter. And there's a very big date in the fourth quarter, and that's the 1st of December. That's the date at which Saudi Arabia takes over its role as president of the G20, which is the world's largest 20 economies. And it will host next year that the G20 countries in Riyadh. So it's a very big year coming up for Saudi. So the noise, the mood in the room is that the IPO will happen to synchronize with the 1st of December and becoming the president of G20.
What kind of valuation do you think they're going to get? We know that they were talking about $2 trillion when this was first mooted. Some have said maybe nearer $1.5 trillion. I know you had some senior Aramco guys at your event in Fujairah last week. What does the mood music tell you about a valuation?
I think it'll be, you know, in the range that everybody has sort of been looking at, 1.5, 2, maybe on the high side. But to be honest, Richard, I think that the valuation dollar number has become less relevant because of the structure of the IPO. It was a much bigger issue when we were talking about, will Aramco be listed in London? Will it be listed in New York? That was made the valuation number a much more important indicator. It was going to reflect what did the international investor value the Aramco, how much was the international investor willing to pay to be a shareholder of what is the world's largest oil producing company. As it's now most likely only going to be listed on the Riyadh Saudi stock market, the valuation is not as important. It's not as big an indicator. It becomes a much more local story in a way, although foreign investors should still have the opportunity to access shares.
Finally, 30 seconds. Can't let you go without asking you about another of our top stories this morning, which is that Saudi Arabia has had 24,000 tourists through the doors since it started issuing visas 10 days ago. I'm sure you're in Riyadh for work at the moment rather than for tourism, Sean, but any evidence of that at all?
Well, certainly you see on arrival at the airport and so on, the tourist desks, etc. And of course, in Dubai, driving down Sheikh Zayed Road, one can't not but see the promotion. I mean, I came in here this week for the first time ever on a one-year multiple entry visa. And so one has to acknowledge that accessing the kingdom, the encouragement for people to come for business and pleasure is clearly evolved substantially. And there is no doubt some very, very significant archaeological sites and beautiful 1,000-kilometer coastline on the Red Sea. So there's no shortage of things to attract a foreign visitor, that's for sure.
Sean, great talk to you. Appreciate you joining us today. Sean Evers is the Managing Partner of Gulf Intelligence, Dubai-based company, joining us on the line from Riyadh in Saudi Arabia.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. The Business Breakfast's Pick of the Papers.
starting with Natasha Thomas from the ARN News Centre, who joins us in the studio. So you're very excited about Hazar, are you not?
We are indeed. So the UAE's first man in space, Hazar Al-Mansouri, will return to the country on Saturday, which is October 12th. He will be joined by fellow astronaut Sultan Al-Nayadi and senior officials from the Mohammed bin Rashid Space Centre on the journey home. Now, after returning to Earth last week, Hazar has been undergoing post-mission medical checkups in Russia, and those tests will be completed by tomorrow. Now, he held his first press conference yesterday, and there was a room full of journalists, as you can imagine, waiting to hear from the man who has basically made history for his country. Very interesting to watch the press conference because he spoke three languages.
Two I could have a good stab at. His Arabic's pretty good, and his English is not
excellent.
Bad either.
Yes, and Russian.
Of course.
And I was fascinated to just watch him switch from one language to the next. You know, I can barely just about speak two languages. And here's a man who, you know, you have to think the language, obviously, to in order to be able to speak it fluently. But he did. He spoke three languages in the press conference. But for the convenience of our listeners, obviously, we've chosen the clips which were in English. So first of all, he explained how he's doing since returning to Earth last Thursday.
For me personally, I adapted in a good way. And also after the flight, I had maybe normal symptoms. That's after 2 days, it's really vanished, and I'm really feeling good now, and I can do all my daily activities in a normal way.
Now, he also confirmed that he has completed 16 scientific experiments, six of which were carried out on the ISS. And he also spoke about what he misses the most. I mean, you would think it's the feeling of feeling, you know, weightless, the microgravity, etc. No, it's actually something else.
I remember that when I just undocked, the thing that's really, the most thing that I really felt is that goodbye my friends on board the station. So I will miss the most thing is the crew on board the station, this mankind from international countries working together for mankind. This is the most thing that I will miss.
How sweet.
It's very, very, I was going to say down to earth, probably an unfortunate turn of phrase, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, he just comes across as a very humble and very, you know, throughout the press conference, you can hear he's constantly praising his colleagues. He's praising the crew who've trained him. He's praising, you know, people down on earth who have basically prepared him for this mission. But the, you know, the most important question, of course, was what happens next? You know, he said his space journey was actually only the beginning of much bigger expeditions for the UAE.
This is only the beginning, and we will continue. I am the first from my country, but it will be continued from a different, also the next generation will continue this exploration in space. And also from the social media, I have a lot of support from everyone around, not from only my country, from also from other countries, from Arab region specifically. So thanks for everyone.
So does he go back to his day job? He's with the Air Force, is he not?
As far as I understand, he will come back and work with the Mohammed bin Rashid Space Center.
Okay,
so
fine.
He'll work on the UAE space program over the next couple of years.
Incredible achievement. One of the big newsmakers of the past 2 weeks, definitely Hazar Al-Mansouri. Another of the big newsmakers of the past fortnight has been Greta Thunberg, the environmental activist.
Exactly, the girl making sure that Hazar has a planet to come back to, you could argue. We've been really enjoying Greta's speech to the UN again this week, but in a slightly different way because people have been sending it to music. It's been some Greta mashups making the rounds on social media.
So, Natasha Thomas, we've got two of the Greta mashups that are doing the rounds. In a minute, you'll hear Brandy's mashup and my mashup. But first of all, the two that are really storming the internet at the moment. Would you like to start with dance music or with death metal?
Death metal.
Death metal. Who's this, Brandy?
This is a guy called John Mollusk. He's a YouTuber, and he took it upon himself to set Greta to a bit of Swedish death metal.
How dare you? You have stolen my dreams, my childhood, your antique words, and yet.
Which Greta was very good about. She's seen the video. She's got flashing eyes and everything. And she's tweeted, "I've moved on from this climate thing. From now on, I will be doing death metal only." But he's not the only one, because Fatboy Slim, the DJ, was performing in Gateshead, and he mixed her speech to his club favourite hit, Right Here, Right Now.
There's some great videos, actually, of people dancing to that as well, doing the rounds on social media, including ours. So Rich and I challenged each other. All right, then, what's the best Greta mashup you can come up with? Both of us were sitting up late last night doing this.
Ladies first, this is Brandy's Greta mashup.
My message is that we'll be watching you. This is all wrong. I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school, on the other side of the ocean. Yet, you all come to us young people for hope. How dare you? You have stolen my dreams, my childhood, with your empty words. And yet, I'm one of the lucky ones. People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you? How dare you?
I love the blending of that classic line about I should be in school with one of the greatest school songs
You've
ever written.
You've chosen the perfect Pink Floyd song there.
Oh, Richard hasn't done badly either.
We had people when we played that first time around, a lot of people wrote in saying that's amazing. Mm. Someone wrote in said, I'm literally in tears driving to work. I don't know if that was tears of emotion or tears of laughter, but either way, it was brilliant. Well, I've done two, one of which producer Shruti and Brandy won't let me play on air. I'll play it to you later after the show. But this is the radio-friendly version, and it's Greta to Alicia Keys.
She's just a girl and she's on fire, filled with catastrophe, but she knows she can fly away. Oh, she got her head in the clouds and she's not backing down.
Our house is on fire. Our house is on fire.
Fire. This girl is on fire.
I have a more Swedish version that I'll play you later on.
No, I love it. I love how creative you both are. That is
but
really
we will
good.
See it sampled quite a lot, won't we? I mean, yes. We know that Beyonce, for example, has taken a lot of beat poets, a lot of feminists, a lot of race activists that she has respect for, sampled them into some of her music. So we don't quite have those skills, but we're working on it.
No, I think we should put this up online.
Well, Jawed disagrees completely. Jawed has written in saying, to be very honest, taking a serious message and desensitizing it by turning it into mashups is a totally messed up way of making it lose its spirit and levity. Thank you, Jawed. Appreciate your message.
We're back bright, early, bushy-tailed, full of beans. And with Malcolm Taylor, Sunday morning, 6 a.m.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.